You're listening to Greater LA, the show on KCRW that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Welcome. Today, we're taking you to a block in a part of downtown LA that has somehow not been rejuvenated. Behind a nondescript warehouse gate, it sounds like there's a party going on. I can't tell you exactly where you are because, the location is secret.
This is where people can come and really kind of feel at home because it's a farmer's market style event. You can come here and really experience the best of what the market has to offer.
That's Aaron Stone. It's not his real name, but it's the name he'll give a reporter because he's participating in something that isn't totally legal, like many of the people you're going to meet in this place. Aaron is one of the vendors at a sesh, a pop-up unlicensed cannabis market. It's one of many across the state, and Aaron's here alongside others selling cannabis buds and concentrates and edibles directly to medical cannabis patients. California's legal cannabis market is on track to hit $3.1 billion in sales this year, legal cannabis. But the thriving unlicensed market is expected to be much bigger, almost three times as big, at an estimated $8.7 billion. So where's all that unlicensed weed being bought and sold? Well, for some of it, right here. KCRW's Abdullah Saeed takes us through this warehouse door to find out how everyday Angelenos are buying their weed.
It looks like a regular weekend farmer's market, except you won't find organic tomatoes and peaches here. I'm inside a large space filled with 20 to 30 picnic tables, each boasting a variety of cannabis products, buds, hash, edibles, and vape carts for customers to choose from. While the phrase black market elicits visions of shady characters selling illegal goods out of the trunk of a car or the inside of a trench coat, what you'll find at this sesh is an open atmosphere, where some people are simply shopping and others are hanging out, smoking, and socializing. Music is booming from the DJ booth, and food trucks are right out the door for when folks get hungry.
I think it's a if you know, you know type of deal, you know what I'm saying? It's not really spoken about or advertised anymore, so it's kind of like if you're in and you know, or if you're cool enough, someone will let you know.
If you're a medical cannabis patient in the know, you can find a sesh in LA on almost any night of the week. The organizers will announce the location via text and social media a couple of hours ahead of time, and all you need to get in is your medical cannabis recommendation.
You got people opening up bags, looking at nugs. You got people heating up nails, ready to get higher. You got people in line waiting for specials. It looks like, you know, every booth has something that they offer that someone else doesn't, be it like, you know, 2 for $10 or buy three, get one free. It's all marketing.
This is Adam, born and bred in the San Fernando Valley. He's the unofficial host of tonight's event. He's got long black hair, blinged out glasses, and a Joker t-shirt. The customers, the vendors, everyone knows him. The place is packed with mostly young, mostly black and Latinx patrons, feeling the good vibes as they smoke and peruse.
I come for the environment. I come for the medicine.
Some are there to party and hang out.
Hey, how y'all doing tonight, man? Everybody getting high. I love it.
Also, there's a practical reason why seshes see so much foot traffic.
Better prices.
I feel like right here is the best prices.
This was still and has consistently been the most affordable place and compassionate. Like, you can actually speak to some of these vendors and, you know, they might be able to help you out.
Like, what you spend $50 here for, you'll probably get a lot more and a lot better stuff than you would spend $50 at a compliance store.
Compliance store, that's a licensed dispensary, like MedMen or any other legal shop. At a compliance store, you pay a sales tax of up to 25%, making products prohibitively expensive for some medical cannabis patients who used to pay no tax on weed at all. Medical cannabis patients tend to consume more than just a small recreational amount. The ones who can't afford current dispensary prices come here to buy wholesale, sort of like a Costco. Not to mention, they don't love the new compliant packaging, which they say is ruining the shopping experience.
If you are over 21, you can just walk into any compliance store and buy weed at a top price with tax, and you don't even get to like look at it or smell it or touch it. So here, you can still experience the product
Adam, the Willy Wonka of this sesh, says these events provide a service for people in need. Where there's demand, there will be supply. And no one's getting hurt in the process.
I don't think they cause that big of an issue for certain folks because we're not causing any violence. There's no trouble going on. We're just kind of our own group of people that know what we like, trying to save money and smoke the best weed.
But finding the best weed can come at its own cost. One customer, Jacob Garcia, who works for Whole Foods by day, says he's been a medical cannabis patient since 2005. As a longtime smoker, he knows that there's some risk involved with buying at a sesh.
I've been doing cannabis for a long time. I kind of know what to look for. I'm not going to say that everything here is clean and safe, but I trust my eye, my nose.
The benefit to buying weed at dispensaries is that products are rigorously tested, so you can trust what you're buying is likely clean. But to sell weed at a sesh, there's no requirement to test your product. Here's Adam.
I'm not saying everything in the traditional market is dirty. I'm just saying you have a lot more risks out here. Now, I personally know some growers, so I can trust the source more, but a lot of these people don't really know what they're looking for in weed. So that's one of the things that people need to educate themselves about before purchasing or even consuming certain products.
And one concern on everyone's minds as of late are the carts. Vape cartridges.
But ever since all the controversy, you know, a lot of people aren't really with those.
He's referring to the recent national concern over vaping-related illnesses and deaths, and data showing that additives found in counterfeit, unlicensed vapes, like the ones found at seshes, could contain dangerous contaminants. The state of California has warned consumers not to vape and not to buy bootleg cannabis products. But a crackdown on carts isn't stopping sesh events and the unlicensed market from thriving in general. Doug Dracob is the owner of Hitman Glass, a pipe and bong company. He's been in the cannabis industry both before and after recreational legalization. He says that sesh events like this one are going to be around for a long time.
There's always going to be a wholesale market for off-the-books cannabis, and to be quite frank, I'm in a financial position where if I have $400, I'm going to buy 2 ounces instead of an ounce. Like, I just can't afford to pay the taxes right now. California is taxing every single level of people that are cultivating, processing, the distributor, and there's no logical reason for any of these people to transition.
Maybe the customers are content not to transition into the legal market, but for many of the vendors at this sesh, going compliant and selling their cannabis in a licensed dispensary is the ultimate dream. Aaron, the first vendor you heard from, said he's tried to transition to selling on the legal market, but that road hasn't been easy.
Here in California especially, it's kind of, there's a lot of red tape and it's expensive for most companies to just jump in. We need to raise capital, and that's why a lot of people are still in the black market.
That being said, he's trying to go legit.
We are currently working on getting a license. The thing is, it's just so expensive because in a lot of these places, you have to build out infrastructure. That's why the black market is currently thriving, because there's all these people that want to do good and that want to provide a good quality product, but the regulations just make it almost impossible to do so. You know, I trust me, I want to be in the recreational market.
An hour into the sesh, there are about 200 people browsing the aisles, smelling nugs, and filling their shopping bags. Vendors can sell enough product in one night to take home thousands of dollars in cash. That's why Adam tries his best to make it a safe environment for everyone there.
We got good security. We're there. You know, I think anywhere where there's a lot of people or a lot of product, you should always have security. You never know what people are going to do or act like.
At the night's peak, an ice cream truck pulls up out front. A bunch of very high folks quickly form a line. It's definitely a great spot to sell some cones. Where there's demand, there will be supply. For KCRW, I'm Abdullah Saeed.
Well, places like the sesh you just heard of are so popular and the illegal market so thrives, despite efforts by local and state officials to crack down. And as you just heard from Abdullah, a big part of that is the cost. The high taxes on licensed marijuana makes for a more expensive product. And starting in January of 2020, that tax is going up. Industry analysts say that's only going to make people buy weed the illegal way and hurt the pot shops that are trying to follow the rules. Mike Fuhrer is L.A. city attorney. He's one of the officials who's had the difficult job of tackling a huge unlicensed market. Welcome to you, sir.
Hey, Steve. Good to be with you.
Do you know about places like that, by the way?
Well, I haven't heard of a place like that, but we're certainly aware of places that don't have licenses that are selling marijuana. In fact, our office has been prosecuting since last year 407 cases involving more than 300 locations. You know, we've shut down almost 200 of them with about 1,500 defendants. So the scope of the issue is huge. One point that I think is exceptionally important for our listeners, though, is to go to an unauthorized shop is to put your health in your hands. Last year, in addition to our criminal prosecutions, we sued a location civilly, and we tested the product. The test revealed that the marijuana was tainted with a pesticide classified as a toxic by the EPA. A major difference between the licensed and unlicensed locations is the authorized sellers must test their products. The unauthorized sellers don't.
I suspect everyone wants to smoke clean weed, but the illegal market, I mean, think about the days when it wasn't legal at all to smoke marijuana. That was the pot that you got, right?
Well, right, but now people have the choice of going to locations where they know the product has been tested and determined to be safe for consumption. The nation has never seen a regime like that before. So for the first time in history, a buyer of recreational marijuana knows they can go to a place that has tested the product they're purchasing. I don't believe in scare tactics. I believe in giving people information and letting them make responsible decisions for themselves. The fact is that public health is jeopardized by going to unauthorized locations.
What do you say to the folks who maybe who are selling clean weed, right? Who are like, it is such a headache to go through this whole rigmarole. The high taxes, you may or may not get licensed. If you have, some sort of pot conviction or, drug conviction in the past, it's going to be much more difficult for you to get licensing. What do you say to those folks who want to do the right thing but feel like they just can't?
Well, several things. First of all, of course, the policymakers in Sacramento locally have the option of determining what kind of regulations they want the licensed locations to adhere to. And if a seller thinks that those regulations are too stringent, I think it's appropriate to go to policymakers and ask for the laws to change. And certainly we want to be encouraging legal sales. Policymakers can change those rules if need be. And in the meantime, those charged with enforcement, like our office, are working very hard.
Are you concerned that the tax increase that takes effect at the first of the year will continue to drive the illegal market?
I think it's a possibility. And I know that in Sacramento there have been moves to recalibrate the taxes for precisely that reason. By the same token, I think the key issue is actually not the regulation of these locations, but rather the demand for marijuana from unauthorized locations, a demand which I think can be reduced with public education about the risks that people incur by going to those locations. Certainly since we brought the action I described earlier, we've heard from many people about surprise regarding what could be in their marijuana. The more we educate people about those risks, the more we'll be ideally driving recreational demand to the authorized locations.
The legalization of marijuana here in California didn't bring in as much money, as much cash as the state was hoping. I think partly because, as we said before, the illegal market is still billions of dollars bigger than its legal counterpart. I mean, how do you think the state is doing so far in trying to reverse that trend?
Well, you know, I think this has been a learning experience, as it were, for everybody in this. As folks are coming to recognize that it may not have been as easy as was first thought to create a recreational marijuana regime in our state that separates licensed from unlicensed locations. I think everybody agrees that it needs to continue to improve.
From a legal perspective, I want to ask you this because there are more non-compliant shops than compliant ones. What's the main issue here that allows for that, do you think?
Well, again, nothing allows for that. I think there are several different issues. One is there's no list of unlawful locations, so law enforcement, communities, and others are left to attempt to identify locations and then investigate them, determine that marijuana is being sold, and then refer those matters over to prosecutors or others who will try to enforce the rules. So it's a big job with many competing priorities for law enforcement as it's involved in that process. Closing down a couple hundred shops since last year is a sign of how seriously we take the problem.
But I wonder, I really think if you go sort of the underground illegal marijuana market, that you get to this place where a lot of people just don't trust the man, as it were. And what do you say to that? How do you get people on board who have been selling pot probably illegally for a long, long time to come clean?
Well, you know, in many ways, this is about money for them, and I get that. You've asked me about how you get the sellers from unauthorized locations to step into the regulated world. And there may be other incentives that policymakers can put on the table to get them to do that. In the meantime, we're focused on disincentives. You know, if you're unauthorized, you could easily get caught and suffer some meaningful consequences.
But as far as trust goes, like, it's always been this us versus them in this realm, right? I mean, when it was illegal for decades and decades and decades, right? You were always under the radar, always the black market, always doing it with the suspicion that you might be caught. And now it's like it's legal and you have a legal way of doing it, but it's so much more of a hassle. I mean, don't you think that that hurts you in the end in trying to get people to really come forward and be above board?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think this is about whether there's trust in the regulators at the state or the city level. I think it's just really mostly about money. I don't think that that formerly adversarial relationship that you're talking about has much to do with whether a business is deciding to try to sign up and become an authorized location. And look, I think it is the case that officials throughout the state need to be finding ways to assure that the lawful businesses are not undercut by those who are flouting the law in the meantime. And that's one key role that we play in my office.
L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer, thank you, sir, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Of course, Steve. Good talking to you.
Well, if you have questions or thoughts about all these issues around legal and illegal marijuana, you can share your comments with us, your questions too, at kcrw.com/ask Greater LA. Let me give that to you one more time. kcrw.com/ask Greater LA. You got questions? We're going to try and find you some answers. Just ahead on the program, there's another homeless shelter going up in Orange County, but one city's asking, why do we seem to be the only ones? Gustavo Arellano, next on KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're off to Santa Ana today in the OC, where there's been infighting about the location of a forthcoming homeless shelter. A recent census there found that the county's homeless population has now risen to nearly 7,000 people living in shelters or on the streets. Well, the city of Santa Ana has more shelter beds than any other city in OC, so the proposal of a new one, well, isn't really sitting well with residents who feel like other county cities aren't really stepping up. It's Monday, time for Orange County Line with Gustavo Arellano. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Why does Santa Ana have more shelter beds than any other Orange County city?
Because if you really want to get down to it, cities in South County, whenever they've gotten homeless people, they've left them in Santa Ana. They've literally driven them up there. And the rest of the county just sees, oh, Santa Ana, it's dirty, it's urban, it's Mexican. So let's just dump any of our problems on Santa Ana. And that's what it boils down to.
Give us a layout of where this fight is, Gustavo. You've always described OC to me as sort of two halves, right? North and South County against one another. This mentality is very different. How does that play into this homelessness issue, do you think?
Historically, there's been five cities in Orange County that's had homeless issues. It's been Costa Mesa, Huntington Beach, lesser extent, Anaheim, Fullerton, but especially in Santa Ana. It's the county seat. That's where the county jail is. So whenever they release inmates, they're out on the streets in Santa Ana. So there's a lot of homeless advocacy groups that historically have been there. But again, the dirty secret that only finally got publicly exposed last year was that a lot of the city police agencies and sheriff's departments, whenever there'd be homeless arrests in the rest of Orange County, but especially South Orange County, they would just drop them in Santa Ana because they didn't want to deal with that problem.
Right,
and so that mentality, it still governs the issue of homelessness to this day.
All right, so there are already more shelter beds in Santa Ana than anywhere else in the county. Where is this shelter going to be, and how many people are we talking about?
So currently there's a shelter right in downtown Santa Ana within walking distance of the Orange County Board of Supervisors. That was a temporary one and former bus depot. So they're going to get rid of that one, which is 400 beds. And the proposal by the county is to build a new one, 425 beds, in an industrial area of Santa Ana, but it's about half a mile away from both a high school and both an elementary school. So obviously residents in Santa Ana, in those areas, they're very upset. They don't want a homeless shelter there. But more importantly, at the Board of Supervisors meeting last week, they went to the county and they said, look, we know what you're doing. You're not building this shelter in Mission Viejo or in San Clemente or in Yorba Linda or other wealthy areas of Orange County. You're building it in Santa Ana because you've always built it in Santa Ana, and those other cities do not want them, and you're going to pay attention to them and not us.
What about those other cities? Do those other cities have something, a counter argument?
Yeah, we're Mission Viejo and you're not. No, literally, that's what's been the argument for the past 25 years. And the official argument that they'll say is, well, you know, there's not as many homeless people here. And so we will deal with our homeless people, and the city of Santa Ana should deal with their homeless people. But again, it's disingenuous given these cities have contributed mightily to the problem of homelessness in Santa Ana for 25 years. So for people who live there, like, obviously they want to deal with the homeless issue, but it's hard when the rest of the county has always been compounding it by just, putting more homelessness there and then just running away from the issue.
There were legal ramifications with this issue of homelessness anyway in the county, right? Bring us up to speed on that and how it fits into what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, for the past couple of years, there's been the lawsuit involving, because remember, 2 years ago, there was a huge homeless population on the Santa Ana riverbed that the county finally tried to solve. And that's when they said, okay, with the federal judge, David O. Carter, saying, okay, all of Orange County now has to deal with this issue. We all have to, every city, every region has to build homeless shelters in their areas. And let's not forget that the cities of South County, they petitioned to remove Judge Carter from that lawsuit, and they were able to succeed. And they were upset again because Judge Carter dared in open court said, I know what you South County cities have always done. You are not to do that again. And they weren't happy with that. South County's never happy when the rest of Orange County says, hey, you think you're holier than thou? Well, we're all Orange County together. And so they never like that. They don't like the truth.
So more beds then in Santa Ana means the next homeless shelter has to be built somewhere else. Is that what we're talking about here?
Supposedly, I mean, you're still supposed to have homeless shelters in South County, but nothing has been built. Nothing will be built. No, I mean, frankly, at this point, the city of Santa Ana should sue every city in Orange County and say, hey, you know what? We've been dealing with this for far too long. It's time you start dealing with the issue, and let's take it to court.
That's obviously already in court, but we'll see how the
another
twists,
court.
Yeah, another court. We'll see how the twists and turns go with this issue. Gustavo Arellano, who writes for the LA Times every Monday, he's here with us on Greater LA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, marionette puppets get a reprieve in Highland Park, and old theater gets new digs. Next on KCRW, The Business with Kim Masters. We are online again at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Share your thoughts with us there. kcrw.com/GreaterLA. I asked the question on my personal Twitter account, at Radio Chio, where does the West Side begin? And you would think that I asked, what is the meaning of life? My goodness, what responses. You can chime in too at Radio Chio. Jenna Cagle, Kaylee Wells, Rico Galliano, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Camito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl all had a hand in today's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear and for your time. Have a great day.